Hello and welcome to Box Set Binge the Bible from Seven Vineyard, the podcast where we are going through the Bible in a year. And my name is Bern Leckie and I'm joined today by Owen Lynch.
Hello.
We have been enjoying time back in the Old Testament looking at the formation of Israel as a people. Really important story, both for its long history and lots of things happening in the world today. But today, I think it's good for us to concentrate on this bit of the story where Israel was first moving in to its promised land. Really, really important historical story, don't you think?
Yeah, and I have a personal connection with this because I visited Jordan several years ago now, and we visited the River Jordan. And you know what I found really interesting? The River Jordan is about as wide as the River Avon in Bristol. Not particularly wide, very swimmable. And it was just really, really fascinating to me that most of what we're reading about here in Joshua and in the Old Testament and New Testament pretty much all happened within a 30-mile radius of where I was stood, as I was stood on the banks of the River Jordan where purportedly even Jesus was baptized. So I just found it deeply resonant. And when I was reading Joshua, it just brought back all those memories of standing on the banks of the River Jordan.
That's interesting to know, because it's sometimes hard, I think, to get a sense of scale about all these stories. You know that the Israelites have spent 40 years in the desert, famously. So then I get an image from that, you know, it's like as big as the Sahara or something, or it must have taken an age to get from A to B. But what you're saying is quite right, that it's actually, well, a bit more than a stone's throw, but it's an imaginable distance. And so what's going on isn't that impossible things have to be overcome, but there's lots of interesting, very important symbolism, I think, in these stories. And that's I think, what I'd like to get to grips with. Just to get from the bit that we last looked at, if you remember a few episodes ago, we skipped over the book of Deuteronomy. So we'd gotten to the point in Israel's story where they were getting ready to go into the promised land. But the bit we missed in Deuteronomy is that the story got recapped and Moses died, we're hearing at the start of Joshua. And the expectation then is that Israel is now ready and can go in and take the promised land. One thing I've noticed in this very beginning of the book is how important attention is drawn to the law. Obey the law. It's very important that God's people are shaped and obey the law. That's the explicit instruction. And then this promise that you will be prosperous and successful. And just having read Job last week, I'm thinking, wow, is it any wonder that Job's friends got a bit mixed up when they took that too simplistically or too literally? Obeying the law, yes, it's very important holding God's people together, but we'll see in the story how there are kind of challenges and sort of other sides of that. The other thing that strikes me is perhaps even more important. I think there's a command that is implicit all the way through this story that certainly isn't said directly at the beginning of Joshua, which is that God's people need to trust and believe in God. That's really important. And I think that's the thing that gets demonstrated in all the things that follow. Does that sound sensible?
Yeah, this theme of faithfulness, we've been following this theme of faithfulness, haven't we, as we read through Exodus and Numbers and Leviticus, this sense of, as you said, you know, if the Israelites are faithful, then there is the inference actually that God will be faithful regardless of how faithful the Israelites are. But there's this strong sense that if the Israelites fail to be faithful to God and follow his ways, then unfortunately there are consequences to that. Not God punishing them necessarily, but just there are consequences from behaving like idiots. And I think that's what we're seeing here in Joshua. And I just wanted to add something there, Bern, around the actual person of Joshua. Because obviously the book is named after this man called Joshua. I think it's interesting to note that the word Jesus is the Greek translation of the Hebrew Yeshua, which is actually Joshua. And so this word we're told is that Joshua means God saves. And Joshua in this story is almost as presented as the new Moses, the new leader of the Israelites, and the, what Joshua says goes. And I think we see that authority on him, don't we?
Yes.
But I like the connection between Jesus and Joshua. This idea that the man we call Jesus of Nazareth was given the name Yeshua. It was Gabriel who told Mary to call the boy Jesus, which means God saves. So there's just this link, and this is reoccurring pattern in the Old Testament, and we see it in the New Testament as well, of God anointing people to save the Israelites, save his people from the consequences of their actions. I quite like that.
Yeah, very good. I love that too. And I think one of the important things I notice about this beginning of the story is that it isn't so much the establishment of a legal order, like here's a bunch of rules and everything will go fine according to the rules. Let's not fixate on that too much, because what's going to happen next doesn't seem to obey all the rules that you'd expect to be obeyed, like the rules of nature. Trusting God seems like the most important thing. This miracle where they're crossing the Jordan, however big it is, whether or not they could have swum it. Yeah, maybe they could have swum it, but that's not the point, is it? The point is that they're crossing it and they're crediting God for what happened, and it's reminding them of coming out of Egypt, and it's reminding them of the Red Sea drying up. And it's not a matter of law. There are no commandments in the law about what to do with your power to stop rivers. You know, because thou shalt not dry up thy neighbor's land. Because it's never their power. But there's a lot that's dedicated at this beginning of the kingdom of Israel to celebrating God's power bringing it about. And so it says quite a lot about these stones that they put down and all the ways that they're going to remember it. And then I'm struck by the whole story of Jericho, and that looking again like other things that look like the beginnings of things and the beginning of a kingdom that God's putting down reminds me, can you guess what it's reminding me of?
No.
I'm thinking it's reminding me of Genesis. It's reminding me of the beginnings of creation, the beginnings of the world, because I'm spotting all these important symbols in there. I'm spotting the use of sevens, the seven priests and the seven trumpets, and their 7 days or six proper days of marching, and then something amazing happening on the seventh day. Yeah. And these walls...
Good spot, Ben. Good spot.
Yeah. Walls, they come down without human effort. The walls of Jericho. And so what's happening? Who's reigning on the seventh day? It's God. It's God's kingdom. And it doesn't describe a story where God strengthened their arms to go and take the walls down. It's describing a story that looks much more like an obvious work of God, that at least God's been given the credit for this, that it's not a human kingdom that's being established by human force, even though there's an army and they're formed in the way that God told them to form. What's being worked out is God's power, and so it's God's kingdom. And because it's God's kingdom, then everything that follows is God's stuff, and they're moving into God's land, not taking their own land. And they've got to listen to God when it comes to how to deal with that. I think that's really important.
Right. And you know, at this point, I think it's good to remind ourselves that we are reading a story that would have been handed down by generation to generation. We're reading a story that was probably put together with all the other stories in the Old Testament at around about the time of exile, when the Israelites had been exiled, or the Jews had been exiled into Babylon, and they are reconstituting their story, putting it down because they fear that they might get lost forever. And of course, that's a really important. This is a really important story about why the land that they've been exiled from is so important to them, because it's God's land. It's land that's been given to them, and they long to return to the land once again. after Exile. So I think you're right to really emphasize that and see that in the text of Joshua. This is a story about why the land is so important to the Israelites and particularly to the Jews, right?
Yes, absolutely. And as glorious then as it sounds, wouldn't it be great to just leave it there? And then it was God's kingdom established and Beautiful. Everything worked out.
Oh, yeah. I like a happy ending, Ben.
You can stop listening now. That's it. No, nothing else happens. Oh, apart from all the death.
Yes.
There's a lot of, and I in my notes, I've just written so much death in capital letters, all the way through. Why is there so much death?
Yeah.
And I think we need to dig into this because this is a challenge, and there are obvious, challenges in how we think about it today. But I think we might talk about that one a bit more next time.
If it's possible, can we just talk a little bit more about the land? Because I want to connect it to what I talked about on Sunday, if that's okay. Mm. We're talking about the land, Bern, and the importance of the land and the importance of the land to those who are living in exile and they long to return to the land. But land at that time was a matter of life and death. If you had land, you could grow crops, you could graze your cattle or livestock, and you would be able to feed your family. But without land, you couldn't do that. That's why land was so important. And this phrase that is we read about in Joshua, the land flowing with milk and honey, that's a metaphor for a fertile land. And of course, this was a very fertile piece of land, watered by the Jordan, beautiful sunny weather, all sorts of wonderful crops, you know, that we probably all would love to eat now, wine and olives and so forth. And there's this sense, I think, for me that when we understand that the land is central to the life of this nation, we can grasp so much more about what we're reading about in Joshua. I think if we place the land at the center of this and the God's provision of that land at the center of this, then I think we understand even that horrible first story that we read about in chapters 7 and 8, when someone called Achan and his whole family are stoned to death and then their bodies are burnt because he steals some of the loot from Jericho. That's a very disturbing story, but is, if you like, is symbolic of the importance of the land to the people. But more importantly, it's not just about the importance of the land to some people, that is the elite, the wealthy, but it's the importance of the land to all people, that God intends the land to be for the benefit of all people. And that if some people are greedy and some people hoard it for themselves, then that is going against God's will, which is that all people would benefit from the land and there would be justice for all, which is why I think we read this very serious story about a whole family and a household being stoned to death for committing effectively an economic crime, theft. Does that make sense?
It does. I think you're reading a lot into that from a kind of overall social justice point of view. When I read this, I didn't quite get the same sense of that's the point of it, as much as I'm getting the sense of God is simply establishing his kingdom. He's simply establishing a new order of things. And that may, I love that we see that results in access and fairness to people who have been poor. But I don't think it's quite adequate for me to read this as a God's being enabling everyone to have more life story, because clearly there isn't more life for everybody in this story. What's happening is that large groups of people are being wiped out so that the Israelites can be given this land. I can't read that in terms of social justice generally. What I can do is read that in terms of God establishing a kingdom, God establishing an order. I don't know how to read that in terms of social justice generally, because I don't think that applies. I don't think it's part of our mission, if we're seeking social justice, to identify people to kill and get rid of so that everyone else can have a better life. I don't think anyone would think that was a good idea. But don't think that's the purpose of the story. I think the purpose of the story is to establish that this is a work of God, a creation of God. It's in the realms of God to be able to say, yeah, there's life here and death here, which is not necessarily our decision to make. And I don't know how to take it in terms of literalism. You know, scholars disagree on this as well. You know, how literal was all the death? We don't know. We know that there's a mixture of stuff happening here. But I don't think that's the point. I think the point is simply to recognize the authority of God and that there is massive change in that. And then when we're talking about this, the Achan, yeah, it does remind me a lot about Ananias and Sapphira that you were talking about in Acts. And I think the thing that comes out to me again from that is, this is what Israel would have thought of when they heard that story of Ananias and Sapphira. You know, not necessarily this is a law that is operating, you know, that we should know how to then deal with people who do anything that looks similar. No, it was more, this is God doing something that is symbolic and represents a very clear statement that the land is his. The land is his and the stuff is his. And it's where we struggle to deal with that when we think we're going to take our stuff, or we're going to treat some of it as our stuff and not recognize it as God's stuff, that we all have a problem to some extent, that we all need to deal with God on that. And in the extreme case, in the example cases where someone gets caught out for directly disobeying God's instruction, God gives this example. God leads in this example. It's not a human justice being carried out thing. It's a God doing something that they make a point. Having made the point, you know, I think, yes, social justice, as you say, can follow. That's part of God's design. But the precursor to that is recognizing God's authority.
So when we look at this story of Joshua, one of the things that a lot of people will have difficulty with is this idea of apparent genocide, where it appears that Joshua is instructing his soldiers to wipe the Canaanites off the face of the earth. You know, scholars, I think, are fairly clear, because there's some it's self-evident within the book of Joshua that actually that sort of language is most likely hyperbolic, you know, in the sense of it's an exaggeration to make a point. Partly because we can see that at times, at different points in Joshua, it talks about wiping them out, and then later on, they've clearly not been wiped out.
Let's be specific about that. That's the end of chapter 11. Joshua took the entire land. And then the start of chapter 13, when Joshua had grown very old, which didn't mean he was just getting on, but it means he was dying, God said to him, you are now very old, stroke dying, and there are still very large areas of land to be taken over. Oh no! The Bible contradicts itself. Well, yes, if you can look at it like that. But actually, the point is, these are different stories being told to make points, and nobody expected them to be literally accurate. So they, just like we saw in Numbers, with stories that overlap, and you can kind of see the joins where they don't fit together. This is that.
Yeah, exactly. And no historian would seriously consider this actual history anyway. But nevertheless, there is a point to be made here, and that is that what the Canaanites symbolize in Joshua is moral corruption, and particularly heinous is this idea of child sacrifice, which is associated with them. And I think what we read in Joshua is that whoever wrote this, whoever put this down, however the stories came to be, there was this sense of, we cannot be like that. You know, we Israelites, we're going to cross the Jordan River, we're going to inherit this land. We aren't actually going to wipe them all out, but there's a sense of, we cannot absorb their cultural values, so to speak, their practices. And indeed, what's very interesting, and we will look at this when we come to Judges, is did the Israelites succeed in avoiding becoming like the Canaanites?
Sure, yes.
And that's the question that, you know, that's the question that the book of Judges, you know, actually helps to answer. And we'll look more about that when we listen to the Judges. But for now, there is this imperative that the Israelites do not become like the Canaanites, with particular regard to what their moral corruption and their practice of child sacrifice. And I think that's, you know, there are such pains to emphasize that the Israelites should not do that they use extreme language to demonstrate how they're going to not let that happen, which is, I think, what we're seeing here in chapters 6 to 12 particularly, which is where obviously we read about all these battles where the Israel has victories over all the different tribes of the Canaanites. It's an interesting piece of writing that tells us so much about Israelite culture, and particularly retrospective Israelite culture, but it doesn't tell us a factual history.
I think that's true. Now, and I think it's fair to recognise, and there may be people listening who go, but I'm sure I've seen websites where people say, no, it is, and we've done the studies and it is accurate. I think it's fair to say there's debate, and archaeology hasn't told us everything we need to know yet, to be honest. Archaeology is still in progress, and archaeology was certainly, you know, it's been the last 100 years when archaeology has been able to have something to say properly and has told us different things about, for example, you know, did the city of A even exist? Which was it? Where was it? What really happened in Jericho? And why is that important? There have been expeditions that seem to show fairly conclusively that whatever is described in Joshua probably happened at a different date from the time it was described. And there are other people who sort of disagree with that, but it depends on whether or not you trust radiocarbon dating and all that sort of thing. The point is that these stories were never taken by its original audiences to have to be literal accounts of things. They were absolutely taken as stories of purpose, stories with meaning, stories that where, you know, you can get to the end of chapter 11 and you've absorbed the meaning of the story that Joshua took the entire land as, yeah, God's powerful. And this is a thing that's happening with God's help. And so that means it can't fail to be completed. But then you can also take the meaning of the bits that start in chapter 13 and go, well, there's still loads to do. And that's a different meaning, because it's a different, again, also relevant and also true story, that they're living in this land and in this region where there's a multiple sets of influences and that are going to be vying for everybody's hearts and minds. So, as you say, that there is truth in the meaning of all of that, and knitting that together, I think we've got to be wise, really, and not fight the battles we don't have to fight about literal, you know, what's literally true, but do absorb the things about, as we said at the beginning, the importance of trusting God, the importance of relying on God, the importance of recognizing God's authority. And wouldn't it be amazing, I think, for me, if I really did live day to day remembering that the land, the house I'm in, and the land that it's on is God's stuff. The things I call mine, I think are mine, are really God's things. I'm just got a license to borrow and use, and that's all I want to be. I want to be part of God's kingdom, using stuff the way God would like us to use stuff, rather than just go, well, it's in mine, and I'm gonna, you know, and I'll give a morning a week to thinking about God if I'm good, you know, and go to church every week. You know, those are two different ways of life, and I want
it's
life,
a mindset, isn't it? It's a
yeah
mindset.
yeah I want the life where God's the foundation and I can learn from that. If I learn anything from Job, it's that if we think we've read these stories, and particularly the legal sides and the things that we think we can turn into rules, if we think we've got our heads around that and now we know what to do and how to advise everybody else, we're so unhelpful. That is not the point. Let's bring these together. And I think the thing that strikes me from these last couple of weeks is how important it is to keep trusting God, and how important it is to keep reminding myself that I've still got a lot to learn about how to use his things.
I think you're right, Bernard. It's a book full of symbolism and powerful imagery that makes these principles stick in our minds, and also evidently in the minds of generations of Jews and Israelites that have followed this heritage of theirs. And I do think that speaks into the present day as well. Obviously, with the land that Israel currently resides on is still fought over, and we're seeing that even now, right now. That for some people, they may be asking questions, oh, should I be taking this literally? And I think you've answered that question fairly clearly. There's such rich symbolism within this book, which is about the faithfulness of God to human beings and whether the human beings actually want to live in that reality with that mindset or not, right?
Yeah.
And it kind of goes beyond the physical. And good, because it means that all of us that don't live in that physical land can actually get to participate in it, right?
Yes.
Rather than just those who lived in that little piece of land, which actually is not very big.
Not very big, but there for a purpose, to be a source of life and light to the world.
Yes, exactly.
So which is why it isn't just a local matter, it affects everybody.
Yeah.
And haven't we felt in the news this week as well that what happens in and around Israel affects everybody, affects the entire world? So I think maybe we should come back to this next week, because next week we'll look at the book of Judges. We'll see the story of Israel in formation developing, but we will still have a lot of questions about how what happened then relates to what we ought to think now. And I'm particularly interested in looking into how Jewish people today regard these stories, and how does it affect the way they treat their neighbours and get into conflicts and see how that goes on today. We can talk more about that next time. What are you looking forward to next week?
Well, I'm looking forward to seeing if Joshua's final speech at the end of Joshua in Joshua 24, which encourages the Israelites to be faithful to God and to because of God's faithfulness to them. I want to see if they really are going to be faithful to it. And I think we get our answer in Judges.
Let's find out as we listen. We'll come back and chat about it next week. See you then.
See you then. Bye-bye.
Bye.